Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Midtown Atlanta, it's time for Top Docs Radio, brought to you by Medical Association of Georgia. With over 7,800 physician members, MAG is pleased to advocate on behalf of Georgia's patients and physicians. Visit MAG.org and on Twitter at MAG1849. Join the conversation on Twitter at Top Docs on BRX.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is C.W. Hall, your host here on the Top Docs Radio Show. Thanks for making us a part of your day today. Over the past year or two, we've been in a partnership with Medical Association of Georgia. They've been coming in a couple times a month, and we've talked about a number of issues affecting medical practice, from the changes in the law and all the different requirements that come with that. And today, we've got an expert that's going to help us understand what are we talking about when we're talking about compliance. We've got Liz Shane with us in studio today, and she has, for the past 25 years, dedicated her legal career to providing in-house counsel for a number of hospitals and clinics around the area. And now she's on her own and outside counsel now, helping medical practices and organizations be compliant with regulations. So Liz, thanks for taking some time, because our listeners are heavy in physicians and physician practice management. So what you have to say will probably have some level of meaning for a lot of people out there hearing us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, introduce us to your background. What took you into law? And then from there, what made you want to get into healthcare in particular?
I grew up in Boston, and I grew up in a physician family, and was relatively spoiled in terms of had a father, grandfather, brother, all of whom are physicians, and really were in medicine for the right reasons. They were at Leahy Clinic and to help people, and were very good at what they did. And I thought I was always going to be a physician until I graduated from college, and then decided that maybe I didn't want to pursue medicine, but I still wanted to help people, and then went to law school at Emory. So healthcare has always been sort of part of the agenda for my career.
Well, when we talk about compliance, what exactly does that encompass? Because, you know, it seems so vague and ambiguous about what falls under that, and what do we need to be thinking about when we look at if we're a hospital or we're a medical practice. What are we talking about with compliance?
Compliance tends to be an ugly word to many people, because they think of auditors and they think of the government and they think of regulation. I think the whole role of compliance has changed over the years, and coming up with a definition is difficult because it's such a broad term, but I think the way that it needs to be approached now is that it has to be a strategic and proactive process by which a person or individual or practice can understand the regulations and determine systematically how to operationalize those regs, and in terms of prioritizing which risk such regulations may pose to the practice.
For me, when I think about compliance, just coming from my exposure in a medical practice, I think about it mostly around reimbursement, you know, documenting that the reasons why we chose the treatments that we did and the studies that we requested, et cetera, that there was legitimate reasons for that, and demonstrating that this is why we're asking to be paid for what we did. But it probably doesn't stop there. I'm sure there's some other, you know, for example, HIPAA, for example, how we handle patients' data. And I'm sure that that's an even bigger concern nowadays, now that we've got all the devices that we're accessing that through and communicating with others around our patients. So, you know, how wide is the net of compliance?
It's pretty broad. And I think that's probably the number one misconception that a lot of providers have, is traditionally compliance has been, or historically has been, part a reimbursement kind of mechanism by which the government will go against providers. And it's always been focused on the back office and the accounting area, the billing area. Over the years, HIPAA's been around since 1996. And so since the enactment of HIPAA, which is is independent of the Medicare, Medicaid regs. And all of the state licensing laws and the professional licensing laws, all of those figures sort of have to be viewed systematically together, because you can't just look at Medicare, Medicaid, and all the fraud and abuse laws. You have to look at them as they relate to the HIPAA regs, as they relate to professional licensing standards, as they relate to other state laws that may or may not apply, such as genetic testing or something.
We've been talking with legal expert on the issue of compliance, Liz Shane, and we're going to be getting into what does a practice need to be thinking about when it comes to managing, are we compliant with the different regulations? Who's typically handling that? Who should be thinking about it? Where do you see people, you know, these organizations go awry around dedicating their resources to?
I think a lot of the, first of all, for physicians, historically, the physicians have been sort of the last to be mandated to have a compliance program initiative by the federal government. Hospitals and home health agencies and long-term care facilities, laboratories have been much more regulated, and it is required to have a compliance program. Only in the past few years, where physicians who have $5 million or more of Medicaid funding, are they supposed to have a compliance program? So the question is, how does a physician practice that doesn't accept Medicare or Medicaid or doesn't reach the threshold where it's mandated, what do they have to do to comply? And strategically, it's good business to have a compliance program. It doesn't have to be so stringent to basically take over your operations, but it has to be part of your operations. For example, I've identified sort of the top five areas that I think physician practices really need to focus on, and those would be contracts, privacy and data security, documentation, the supervision of mid-levels, physician assistants and nurse practitioners, and telemedicine. Those are sort of the top five areas that I think are most pervasive within, whether they're single medical specialty practices or multi-specialty practices. And those, it's a need to understand how each of those areas affect one another.
How when you talk about contracts, what are you talking about? Are you talking about with insurers, or whose contract are you talking about?
Any written contract or non-written contract that may be an agreement. And you can basically say, you know, if I look at a medical practice, at one area that there were over thousands of contracts for a large multi-specialty practice. Hospitals have millions of contracts. So basically they range from insurance, managed care contracts, to vendor contracts, contracts with other providers of services. And here's a kicker, business associate agreements that are required under HIPAA for those vendors who are basically, for those providers who are outsourcing something that would give a vendor access to their protected health information.
I see.
Lease agreements, any kind of agreement that sort of implicates regulations that you need to understand and make sure they're part of the agreement. For example, people forget that anytime whether it's a commercial payer or a governmental payer pays you, there's a contract at issue. So you need to, physicians and their team need to understand what are part of those contracts, because they're usually documentation requirements, they're usually compliance requirements, and those will impact other areas such as your compliance with HIPAA and your privacy, as well as some of your documentation requirements.
So with regards to getting into exposure to risk, how do those types of contracts, I mean, how do they really get me into trouble? How do I need to evaluate them to make sure that we are steering clear of problems?
First of all, it's understanding what the terms of your contracts are. A number of people typically make a mistake of signing a contract with a, quote, evergreen provision that says this will automatically renew for 5 years. And people don't understand that if you want to terminate that contract during that five-year period and you don't follow the notice requirement, you are required to abide by that contract for the next five-year term. You've got insurance provisions that need to be looked at. For example, business associates, if you're contracting with a vendor to have access to your patient information, you want to make sure they have cyber coverage. You want to make sure they have the coverage. So if there is a breach, you can get indemnified for those kind of provisions. You want to make sure that you understand a lot of the Medicare Advantage contracts with commercial payers have mandatory compliance processes that you need to understand, so that you need to make sure that you have policies and procedures in place. And you know, for the IT contracts, for example, which tend to be very expensive, you know, you have to be able to distinguish between not only the regulatory risk, but also the financial risk. And so it's really, in terms of best practices, it's really making sure that the person who is entering into and negotiating contracts within a physician practice sort of has a checklist of issues that they know to address on every single contract and not just sign it away.
In the practices, I mean, before we went on the air, I mentioned the fact that the practice I was a part of, we had a healthcare attorney, but is that, I guess, not necessarily going to be the only resource that you need to be compliant with the regulations that you're talking about, I guess?
Well, as it relates to compliance, you know, one of the factors is, you know, as an outside counsel person, you tend to focus only on the language in the contract and not really the operations. To successfully comply with the regulations, you need to figure out how these regulations and these contractual provisions affect your operations. So I'm a healthcare attorney, but having in-house experience, for example, you are part of the daily operations and you are working with the various players to teach them, whether it's a clinical, whether it's the risk management, whether it's, you know, your executive team, whether it's the physicians, to teach them how to comply with certain regulations, such as privacy, what you are, especially with the IT folks, because there are technical components under HIPAA as well as, you know, general administrative components that you really need to sort of combine a whole bunch of different people involved with your operations.
There are more and more practice specialties out there that are utilizing telemedicine as a means of extending their practice or adding additional layers of service. How is that affecting the issue of compliance?
Well, with telemedicine, it usually involves a number of different players. You've got your other providers that are part of the telemedicine. You've got a vendor who's actually providing the technical services to do the telemedicine. So there's a lot of protected health information being exchanged through that. So you have to make sure that you have controls in place to protect that information. Under federal and state law, you have billing requirements. You've got certain issues about scope of practice from a licensing standard. You've got a whole bunch of different issues that you need to make sure that you address at the front end, as opposed to just entering into these arrangements and then finding out that you didn't have the protections in place to protect a patient's information.
I'm sure that, I know that, you know, getting a hold of patient information for a wide range of reasons is on the rise. And I guess you were talking about the fact that if I have the right sort of language in place on my contracts when I have one of those vendors, or whether I have a vendor or not necessarily, I guess if I've got patient data, I mean, how do I best protect myself beyond, you know, having some sort of something in a contract around patient information?
Well, one of the mandates under HIPAA, and just as a best practice, is to make sure you have not only other controls in place, you have education. You educate the people that you're working with in your group who have access to patient information. You have daily or regular monitoring of your business associates. There's a recent case, and if you look on the Office of Civil Rights website, you can see it, where a physician orthopedic practice was held liable for $750,000 for not having policies and procedures in place dealing with a business associate who actually breached HIPAA, the privacy. So the physician practice was held liable. And what is happening more and more that physicians have traditionally been somewhat protected by immunity because the government has typically gone after more institutional providers. And it's only been the egregious cases where physicians have been involved where it's really patent fraud. But now they're really going after physicians a lot more, whether they are participating directly or even indirectly in an improper arrangement. I was showing somebody the other day that the Office of Inspector General now has a video on their 2016 news update that is worth watching for every single physician that talks about physician fraud. And they were specifically saying that just because a vendor, I think it was a radiologist, sort of tried to solicit other physicians to participate in an improper referral arrangement under the anti-kickback and Stark statute, they not only held the radiologist liable, but they went after all of the participating physicians under the civil monetary penalty. So all of those physicians participating in that arrangement were also fined. So and physicians get solicited all the time by vendors because whether it's a laboratory, whether it's a pharmaceutical company, whether it's anybody, because people realize that they are in charge of the patient relationships. And, you know, so typically physicians tend to, and they're trying to do the right thing, but they really need to understand the ramifications for some of these arrangements that even if it looks like it's legitimate, it may or may not be legitimate based on sort of hidden referral arrangements.
How often do you run into that where they're talking about the anti-kickback and Stark laws, how often do you run into problems with that requirement? I'm sure that sometimes they kind of accidentally stumble into getting sideways with that law. And can you, for the listener, talk a little bit about, you know, what exactly that we're talking about with Stark and anti-kickback?
Well, in a simplified fashion, the federal law prohibits both Stark and kickback, you know, one's civil and one's criminal, but the federal law prohibits offering an inducement, whether it's in cash or other in kind, to refer patients under the Medicare, under a federal health program. So the Sunshine Law, which is also sort of come out, which is basically where the government has mandated that pharmaceutical and manufacturing companies disclose what they are paying physicians for free lunches, for any kind of research, for whatever they're paying physicians, trips and all that stuff, that is now publicly disclosed. So that where the kickback issues typically arise is in a number of different ways. One is the whole lease issues. To a lot of physicians, especially the small rural, have handshake arrangements with other practices to provide where it might be a consulting physician that goes into a primary care and they are kind enough to give them space and do, you know, for 4 hours. Well, the law requires that it has to be in writing. So the simple solution is to get a lease agreement. The other arrangements are where especially investment companies, if physicians want to invest in something, you know, you have a lot of laboratories trying to solicit and startups trying to solicit physicians as investors. And even though the contract may say this, you don't have to refer patients, the only way that these physicians can make money in the long run as an investor is if they refer their patients for these lab services. And that can be pretty improper. And it just other arrangements where there are lots of freebies involved. Some of my experience is the whole, pharmaceutical companies providing free meals to their employees and free lunches and breakfasts and all that stuff. And rather than go over, you really have to just really analyze what the facts are and determine if it's worth having the exposure, because all those costs that are being given to or by these pharmaceutical companies or other vendors are going to be reported under the Sunshine Act on the federal website.
I would imagine that the last year or two, particularly as the ACA has been more and more implemented on a wider scale, that documentation around the reimbursement side of things is one of those areas where unwittingly you can leave yourself open to a RAC audit or penalties or even criminal penalties if you're not careful.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that has made the whole documentation crisis or documentation mm-hmm. issue a crisis is the whole electronic medical records. And, you know, while it is being required that everybody goes to electronic medical records by a certain date in the future, it also creates a number of compliance issues because if you know anything about EHRs, electronic health information, there's just a lot of duplicative information that is on. And it's, you know, the learning process for physicians and staff to understand how to take some of these old charting records mm-hmm. To understanding how to document electronically not only one care episode but for a specialty practice the entire episode of a patient's it creates all sorts of compliance issues because one of the issues that the government has raised is what they call cloning, which is copying and pasting certain episodes. And as a result, if a physician or another provider is just copying and pasting the same thing from one visit to the next to try to make it easier, the government has come out and said, you know, there, you can't show medical necessity. And if you do this consistently, you're essentially creating a potential false claim by submitting a bill for this.
That's interesting because I remember it wasn't a very sophisticated EMR compared to the Epics of the world and Cerners and you name the big time EMRs. It was really more specific to the wound practice, but there was basically drop down type information that would populate a paragraph of charting, if you will, like that. Only it wasn't the doctor cutting and pasting, but it was more or less like that. I mean, and you would see potentially the same language in this patient's chart and that patient's chart if they were, say, both a diabetic foot ulcer and the physician did some basic debridement on it. It might be that same paragraph, or at least a lot of it might be the same. So it sounds like that's now a risky thing.
It is a risky thing. And what in past experience, the way we resolve that is probably the best way to train physicians on documentation is on an individual basis. And I had hired a nurse practitioner or a nurse to basically be my clinical nurse auditor who would work directly hand in hand with the physicians to show them how to improve it. Because in addition to this cloning issue, you also have commercial payers, Medicare Advantage plans, looking at their records. And as part of their risk adjustments, looking at people's documentation and determining whether or not the physician and their staff appropriately documented the episode of care to see if it's more chronic, you know, so that they could basically determine the risk evaluation of that the clinical care.
Have they now, I mean, because I've been away from the practice for a little while, but I mean, with the electronic health records, are they basically requiring that they kind of do away with some of that pre-population of text?
You know what? It really comes down to the specific practice to say, okay, if you look at the old medical record, the paper medical record, can you capture in the patient's chart the entire care plan that you're seeing this patient, not only for this one episode, but from the day you started seeing a patient through the future. Interestingly, I was helping a client in Texas who's also licensed to practice law in Georgia on an issue and looked up that under the Texas Medical Board, who issued a position statement about the accuracy of medical record keeping, and they are mandating that physicians and practitioners be proactive to improve their EMRs so that they can ensure that patient care is accurately reflected and that other providers can rely on that electronic medical record to determine what's going on.
So are they making them start going to more free-form text, if you will, much like a progress note in the old handwritten chart?
Yeah, they're making, so I'll read it here. Therefore, it is incumbent on healthcare practitioners to be proactive and ensure that their EMRs improve patient care by verifying that EMR data / information, one, reflects accurate and complete information relevant to patient care, two, memorialize each patient cares over time, facilitate communication and coordination among all patients' healthcare team, guide those providing future care, is transferred and exchanged with patients, satisfied all regulatory duties, and assists in tracking for patient recall the event of new health threats and new treatment options. So this is the Texas statement. I wouldn't be surprised if other medical boards started issuing similar things.
Well, that's an interesting consideration. I would imagine that it'll probably have some folks scratching their heads about how to tackle that, because when it comes to the EMR, I mean, in large part, they're supposed to be time savers, but you don't have to talk to too many physicians to get the impression that it is anything but in many cases. And to be able to have some measure of pre-populated text, I'm sure helps that a lot.
Yep.
But at the same time, sounds like it might be, if depending on how, I guess, how much of that pre-populated text is documenting what you're doing, could really expose you to some risk. That's interesting. I never really thought about that.
It really does. And the problem is that, I mean, there's some vendors who are very much on top of this, and there are other vendors who aren't, or because of the way in which their whole EMR system is structured, it's difficult for a provider to have specific solutions made for their EMR service. And, you know, the whole EMR, while it's supposed to sort of make things easier, it's actually, I mean, it's just going to take some years to get this perfected, and because the technology is not perfect right now.
It's surprisingly difficult to replace paper in certain ways. Going to the EMR and using that opportunity to have some of my text generated by the, you know, by me just clicking drop downs seemed like a way to go, but it sounds like folks may have to rethink that a little bit.
Well, but there's some great advantages to the new systems, where the EMR systems do allow providers to speak with their patients electronically. So you don't have to wait till you have a telephone call or an office visit. You can just do this by email, which to me is a wonderful thing. It allows patients, a lot of EMRs have portals that allows patients to obtain their data. And so there's some huge advantages and breakthroughs that haven't existed in the past.
What about when it comes to physician extenders, nurse practitioners, PAs? Most primary care offices nowadays have them, and many, many specialties obviously are utilizing them to be able to handle the patient load through the course of the day. I haven't seen my actual cardiologist in a long, long time. It's just been the nurse practitioner. When it comes to the discussion of compliance and regulation, how does having one of those or groups of those in your practice affect things?
You've got a number of different issues. First and most importantly is understanding the scope of practice and the state regulations that govern both nurse practitioners and PAs, and they differ somewhat. For example, in Georgia, a PA has to have a job description with the physician. A nurse practitioner can be a little more autonomous, but they have to adhere to the Nurse Practice Act. But where the compliance issues arise is making sure that the physicians and the nurse practitioners understand the supervision requirements. In Georgia, for example, they limit the number of PAs and NPs that a physician can supervise. Mm-hmm. It's making sure that happens. And a lot of times, especially because many times they're awesome to have and they're very good at what they do. But the physicians forget that they're liable for the acts of these PAs and NPs. And sometimes, so that there is constant, you need to have that constant communication and an update between the two parties so that the physician knows what's going on with the practice. Because sometimes, especially if they're not located in the same building, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit of space, some of that supervision may be compromised a little bit.
Talking with healthcare law expert Liz Shane about compliance on a number of fronts that affect a typical physician practice. When it comes to those physician extenders, I mean, what exactly constitutes supervision? I would imagine, from a compliance perspective, I would imagine that is probably one of those places where people get into some murky waters, particularly when the physician extender is operating in another location.
Well, first of all, initially, both the PA and the nurse practitioner, the practitioner has to have a protocol that has to be submitted to the composite board, especially if, and to the nursing board, but also to the composite board, if a physician is going to delegate prescriptive authority to the nurse practitioner. There are certain, and the same is similar to a PA, which is through a job description. But the supervision requirements is not only the clinical, but there's certain mandatory number of charts they have to review on a routine basis to make sure that the mid-level is doing what they're supposed to be doing. I think best practice is to make sure that there is active communication, you know, regular meetings between all of them. Probably the best practice that I've seen is an OBGYN practice in Cartersville that I was part of, where the physicians and the nurse practitioners worked hand in hand in terms of really helping the physicians delegate, but there was constant supervision, but the nurse practitioners could deliver the babies and all of that, therefore giving. But there was supervision as backup for the physicians. But it really is going to depend on the relationship that a physician has with that practitioner. Sometimes I think there's a tendency of the physicians to think, oh, I can leverage my skills by hiring more and more nurse practitioners and all that stuff and make more money. Mm-hmm. But they forget that they have to supervise and mm-hmm. really that their actions are dependent upon, they're going to be liable for the actions of others.
Yeah. And I would imagine that's one of the places that things can break down is how effectively they're reviewing charts. Because if you miss some things and then something happens, then I guess that's the point at which it really reveals itself.
Well, and that's where I think the office managers need to be involved to make sure, you know, I think with physicians, it's, you know, the big institutional providers have the resources to hire a compliance officer who can sort of incorporate that into their daily routine. I think with smaller physician practices, the office manager is probably the person who's going to end up having to deal with most of the compliance issues. And that just needs to be part of the office practice, is to make sure that is happening on a routine basis.
For that practice out there that is not an employed practice, they're independent and maybe they're not very big enough to have a compliance officer per se. I mean, what's the best advice for them to have a high level of confidence that they're truly touching all the bases that they need to?
I think it needs to start with the physician owner, to make sure that the physician is buying into the whole process, that he or she needs to have somebody at the ground level, whether it's the office manager or somebody who can own compliance and sort of be the driver of all the different areas. You can't know it all. But there are a significant amount of resources that are available. They're free. The government over the past few years has done a great job of updating its websites. You can get free educational stuff from the CMS website, from the OIG website, from the Office of Civil Rights website. They have, you know, Medicare, MedLearn Matters. So there's a lot of documentation. There's a lot of documents that you could do free of charge. You know, obviously they can hire somebody to help them, educate them, and sort of train the trainer activity. I think it's always a good idea to have somebody come in and do some kind of baseline audit of your billing issues, which is not me. but you know, just so that a practice can feel comfortable that their accounting processes, their billing, everything is in the right. And then if for some reason it needs to be enhanced, they can work on those areas.
What kind of person would that be that they would need to have do an audit on their billing practices to be sure they're good?
There are a lot of reimbursement specialists out there. You want to make sure that you hire a reimbursement specialist who knows that particular area of practice. So if you're in orthopedics, who knows, understands how the whole billing for orthopedics.
I see.
But there are a lot of different and very good consultants out there who can do that.
Where do you see the practices typically going off the rails? Where do they, when it comes to compliance, where do you see most of the mistakes?
It's probably most of the mistakes are inadvertent. And it's almost due to ignorance because they don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's just basically apathy and not doing anything. So I think that's probably the riskiest area. So that if you are a physician practice that has been successful and have had the same staff years and years and years and years, I see that as a potential red flag, because my question would be is how they may be a phenomenal practice, but like all of us have to keep learning new and new things, and is to make sure that the staff who have been together for all of those years are keeping up to date with all the changes that are going on. And there are a lot of changes, but it's constant recreating oneself.
So do you just have to basically, would the best advice be to make it a habit of cruising through the CMS website and some of these others on a regular basis? How do you keep up with the new changes?
Yeah, you can get on all of these listservs free of charge. You can make sure you get all the emails from the Office of Civil Rights for HIPAA. You can make sure you get all the emails for the listservs for CMS, and you can make it specific to your practice if you wanted to. I really think it's important for people to go to their professional associations and go into a seminar, go to something where they're going to have people talking about different issues. You know, in terms of training and education, the way it works best is, and it's going to depend upon the physicians, but if one can train an office manager who's sort of been running the show for a long time, they're going to be the best trainer of their team, because, you know, so it's sort of the train the trainer, but it's making sure that office manager is giving the time and resources to be to learn all that. And many times the physicians want to learn it. So, and the same holds true for physicians, get them sort of educated and go to professional associations.
Do you have any final thoughts before I let you get back to the office? I know I've got you in the middle of the day.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. And I think my final thought is that the government right now is almost giving physicians the ability to drive medicine with all the changes in healthcare. And I think if physicians and their teams incorporated compliance strategically into their practice, they are going to be the drivers of medicine, and which is where it needs to be in the future. And so I think the physicians really need to incorporate compliance related issues in terms of their strategy, and not just focus on the new revenue cycle, but include all of the different issues at one time so that they don't have to come back and clean up things they may have forgotten.
Tell the listeners how to get in touch with you, where they can go for more information about your firm.
I can be reached at my email, which is reshane@mindspring.com, or you can reach me by cell phone. And I think that there's a link to a website where I serve as a consultant to a strategic consulting firm.
And what's that?
Progressive Healthcare.
Okay. progressivehealthcare.com/Liz-Shane. And Shane is spelled S-C-H-O-E-N. So her email is reshane, that's S-C-H-O-E-N @mindspring.com. Make sure you reach out to her and get set up to have her come by and talk to you about your practice, keep you out of the trouble spots.
Great. Thank you very much.
If you haven't done so already, go to the upper left-hand corner of the show page. You'll see the Apple logo there. That'll take you over to the Top Docs Radio Show podcast. You can subscribe to us. That way, each week when the new episode comes out, it's downloaded straight to your device, ready for you to check out when it's convenient for you. We hope you turn around and share this information with your social media networks, because you might just be putting information in the hands of somebody that you care about that makes a big difference for them and their lives. And we'll say thanks in advance for that. All the folks over at Medical Association of Georgia want to say thank you. We've been enjoying that partnership very much. Great guests that we've had on the show, including you, Liz. Thanks for taking some time to sit in with us today. And we'll look forward to catching up with everybody same time, same place next week. We'll see you then.